Welcome to the Rand CRE Show. Commercial real estate with no stone left unturned.
Hey, everyone. This is Mike Taravella, and welcome to the Rand CRE Show. I'm with my co-host, Will Coleman. Will, how's it going?
It's going well, Mike. Just running the marathon one step at a time and looking forward to learning from our guest today.
Absolutely. And for those who don't know, the Rand CRE Show is sponsored by Rand Commercial Real Estate, where we help passive investors seek opportunities and we help active sponsors when it comes to financing. So if you have any questions, reach us at info@randcre.com. And Will, how about you enter our rock star guest today?
Absolutely, Mike. So today we have on the show, we've got Rob Beardsley. He oversees acquisitions and capital markets for Lone Star Capital. He's identified, negotiated, and structured over $100 million of multifamily real estate transactions. He has evaluated over thousands of opportunities using proprietary underwriting models. He has a popular newsletter read by hundreds of real estate professionals and published over 50 articles about underwriting, deal structures, and capital markets. And we just got the scoop that he's releasing a book called The Definitive Guide to Underwriting Multifamily Acquisitions, which will be released May 26th. So check that out. How's it going, Rob?
Doing well. Thanks for having me on the show.
Absolutely. And so we know coming into the show, I think underwriting is a big peace of mind, especially with everything going on. So I think the one big question we want to touch on is, how is your underwriting for future rent and expenses change given everything going on right now?
Right. So our COVID underwriting, we've taken, I don't know if it's a unique approach. I haven't gotten the full scoop from everybody else, but the way that we've decided to approach it is rather than throw away our pre-COVID models and say, well, every assumption must go, rents are different, expenses are different, rent growth, everything's different. We've tried to limit it to a few key levers that we can pull to really try to incorporate this new reality we're in, without drastically getting too bearish or changing our assumptions and that kind of thing. So the things we're focusing on are stabilization timeline, going in vacancy rate, and hold period. So the hold period answer is twofold. So if you were underwriting to a 5-year hold and now you're at a 7, it's one, it's going to reduce your IRR just because of the time value of money and the way that it's going to take your pop in value and spread it out over a longer period of time. So that implicitly raises your return requirement. And number two, giving yourself more time in your underwriting allows you to work out the kinks and wrinkles of whatever is to come. If we go into a recession or it's a quick V or it's a nasty 2-3 year period, having those extra couple years or even 5 years is enough to let you ride it out and hopefully sell and meet your expectations. So that's the hold period. And then the going in vacancy is pretty straightforward. Obviously, things are uncertain today. I mean, collections have been pretty good all in all things considered, but things might get worse. And so I think stressing you're going in vacancy and just assuming that your collections are going to drop and things, if you're buying something new, right? And then the last one is stabilization timeline, which I think is something that people are aggressive with to begin with. Some people might just say, well, year one, I'm going to get it all done. It's going to be fully upgraded. Rents are going to be popped $150. And that actually skews your numbers so much more than you would think, because depending on how your underwriting model is built, because it just starts driving and compounding on itself. If you've got 3% rent growth behind the initial pop in year one, you're just going to end up somewhere way further ahead of a different assumption. So I think lengthening out your stabilization timeline, you'd be surprised to see how much it affects the returns. But if you just do those three things, you're going to see that a deal that underwrote to a 20% IRR pre-COVID, you change those three things a little bit, it's going to be a 15 or even lower. So it's really demanding a premium out of deals today.
And say the three things again. So stabilization timeline, going in vacancy, what was the third?
Hold period.
Perfect. I just want to make sure.
And I think another wrinkle is the way that we approach stabilization timeline. And obviously this is heavily important for a value add where you have, let's say 200 units to renovate. Maybe you've got some high vacancy that you're trying to cure. And let's say you're going to spend 24 months doing that. In our assumptions, we have no rent growth baked in during that stabilization timeline. So we've just got 24 months to implement our business plan. So we're effectively forecasting for the next 24 months, 0% rent growth, which I think is, it used to be conservative, but today it's probably just accurate. And all the while, expenses continue to grow at 2%. And typically, we're growing at 2% thereafter on the rents.
And have you gotten an average of how much you're expecting discounts from sellers? I don't know if you guys are making offers right now, but have you made any offers and have any pulse on the level of decrease of value so far?
So we're definitely making offers, trying to get a feel for what's going on in the market. I would say that unless it's a unique situation, the biggest discount we're seeing is about 10% from sellers. And I think that's not really adequate, depending on how you're financing the deal. As you guys know, with the agency holdbacks, that's pretty much bringing value down by 10% alone. Just even though interest rates are lower, LTVs are lower, and the holdbacks really kill your deal. So that's not enough, the 10% discount. So right now sellers are here on their 10% discount, and I think buyers are another 10% below. So we've got this 10% gap, which is really killing transaction volume. I don't think many deals are getting done today.
No, yeah. I was just saying, I'm in that boat too, of just the Fannie and Freddie don't, you know, the deals we're looking at are agency, and those, the sellers aren't even, that we've seen, aren't even distressed. So they don't even want to take that 10% haircut that you've seen. But Fannie and Freddie, like you said, with the syndication model, it's much more difficult to get those deals to make sense. And I think you brought up a really good point of that stabilization period going longer. I've seen a lot of deals come through of, well, I think you nailed it on the head of, oh, if you upgrade every unit, you're one. And then 3% on top of that, you're just compounding error. And I think year one's hard enough of taking the keys, getting the management in place, making sure that's going smoothly, let alone on top of doing so many turns a month. I've seen, you know, 3-5 a month, and I'm like, those are aggressive on top of just the general repair and maintenance. So I think it's just important that you stress that stabilization income or stabilization period, and then just extending that even longer, because that's a huge piece of acquisitions as well.
Absolutely.
So in terms of your returns, that's funny. Are you, because there's more risk in the market now, right? And generally return is a reflection of risk. You know, it's baked into the formula essentially. Are you expecting higher levels of cash on cash returns in IRR, or are you expecting the same or less? Like, what makes a deal worth it for you now in terms of cash on cash and IRR?
Yeah, so it's tough because you've got opposing forces. The fundamentals have weakened, and now you have to actually underwrite to lower cash flows, which then reflect in lower returns. And then it's a question of also raising your return hurdle. So now you've got two forces acting on lower pricing, right? Worse fundamentals, higher risk premium, you know, that's double lower prices. So we're trying to find a way to stay active and still find ways to buy deals without, I mean, if we just say, well, we're only going to buy a deal if it's 20% off, we may miss out. There may be one deal, but it may just be distressed and it may be accurately priced at a discount at 20%, really not be a bargain. So again, that's why I tried to say those three things, which are still, if you still do those three things, it's going to whack the value, but you're still being pretty optimistic. I didn't throw away my value add. I'm still assuming that the value add opportunity is there. It just might take longer. And that's the trouble. Some people are saying value add is dead. I'm just going to keep the rents flat. And that's it. You'll never buy anything. So if you just put the value add on pause, you'll be able to find value. So I think in terms of what we're out in the market, we haven't really raised our return hurdles that much because our changing underwriting assumptions have really done that for us. And also if you're doing the Fannie holdbacks, or if you're going to do permanent financing, you know, you really have a low risk capital structure with the ridiculous amount of holdbacks and the lower leverage that they're offering. So I would say the risk and the fundamentals might be higher, but your capital structure might have a lower risk. So keeping the return hurdles the same, I think, is something reasonable to do, especially if you ever want to buy anything. If you just say, I'm only in the market if someone's going to give me a 25 IRR, I don't think that's going to happen, but not in multifamily. We are looking at, on a totally other side of the business, we are looking at performing and non-performing loans. And I think there will be some decent risk-adjusted returns there in the mid-teens, potentially even high teens if you're able to get something that's non-performing and get the keys to the property. But for good quality multifamily, I think the best discount you can anticipate is something around 10 to 15%. So our return hurdles, to answer your question, are going to be still somewhere in the mid to high teens on a project basis, depending on the risk. And I think our cash on cash is going to be skewed to being a little bit higher in the 9% range.
Awesome. Yeah, I think that's huge too, especially because it's only been a month out. And even though there has been a lot of change, the last thing you want to do is drastically change the goalposts to you and your investors, especially when you have as many models and as investors as you do. The last thing you want to see is, wait a minute, why is this a huge change? Or why is any veers in your strategy? I think your investors kind of then get scared, kind of like the stock market. That halted, everything free fell. And if you just veer the other way, then they're questioning your strategy going forward and beyond. So I know you mentioned the performing, I guess, why that change in strategy for your acquisitions?
Yeah, so because of that pricing disconnect, like you mentioned, sellers that are in good shape, there's no need for them to sell. So many deals were on the market, they got pulled off the market, sellers are just going to hang tight and hope for a better day. So transaction volume on the acquisition side is way down. So we're just trying to find the opportunity in the market, and where we think there'll be more opportunity is on the debt side, since there might be more stressed or distressed sellers of loans than there are of property, depending on the lender's capital structure. So we're looking to pick up yield from lenders that are selling at a slight discount, or actually buy non-performing properties that we can work out with the borrower and potentially, like I said, take possession of the asset. So I think that's where more opportunity is today than looking for straight acquisitions.
And where do you find that debt? Do you call the lender, or how is that kind of structured?
Yes, for the last week or so, we've been calling up a bunch of lenders, getting a lot of no's, like, no, we're in great shape, or no, we're fine, or call us later. But there is some stuff in the market, and obviously talking to brokers. So it's just kind of like acquisitions of property. You've got off-market deals that you're calling direct to owner, or you've got brokers. So that's the same side on the notes.
Go ahead, Mike.
I was going to say, that's kind of, I'm glad we're in all the same book, because literally calling the brokers and everything's no, or it's a place you don't want to be in. So I'm glad we're still fighting the good fight and trying to find value performing assets, or even non-performing, that actually makes sense in the market. So that's a very creative way to go around and still get traction in the acquisition space.
Yeah, and I've been calling lenders as well. I think we're kind of have the same scent, Rob. And a lot of the lenders that I've spoken to say that they save those distressed debt for their, top clientele. So we'll see how that changes over the next couple of months, but definitely something interesting to keep an eye on. When you're underwriting deals, do you run across a lot of errors that people make in terms of their underwriting? Is there any kind of just generic errors that you see people make that you think might you could shed some light on?
So it's tough because there's errors, and then there's kind of flavor or preference in how you make certain assumptions or how you build the model. So for example, kind of it's funny, the way to calculate terminal valuation, right? Pretty simple. You take your NOI at the point you're selling, and then you capitalize it with an exit cap rate, and that's what you're going to sell at, right? And that's what everybody does. But the question is, what NOI are you using? If you're going to sell in year five, are you going to use the trailing 3 months in year five? Are you going to use the trailing 12 months? Are you going to use forward? Are you going to use the year six NOI? And so I think there's no error there, but I mean, in my opinion, there is an error. I use the T12, or so the year five NOI. I think year six NOI is just kind of an extra level of aggressiveness that is not really necessary. But I know that, you know, professors in real estate finance, they do teach forward-looking revenue or forward-looking NOI. So I think it just depends on your flavor. So that would be one thing. In terms of an error, I think a big thing is missing out on CapEx. Depending on your business plan, there may be a lot of recurring CapEx that you don't have factored in. And simply the $250 or $300 per unit per year requirement that the lender has you reserve up on a monthly basis is just not sufficient if you've got a 70s, 80s vintage property and you're not putting a ton of money up front into it. So I think that's one way that, I mean, typically that's not going to be factored into the property in terms of your NOI being your cash flow, but there's actually potentially some below the line expenses that are there that are not really accounted for. So we're always trying to account for that either by having a larger CapEx budget up front or finding ways to increase our ongoing CapEx in the model.
I had to laugh at the NOI piece because seeing the brokers every once in a while to do a T1, annualize that, and I'm like, eh, I didn't see that make Rob's list of the NOI to use. But, and also too, I think once you said the CapEx piece, I knew you were going to say the 1970s because we have a couple properties and we, you know, you raise a lot of money on the front end because you're always going to have the plumbing issues, plumbing. And we have even our first week of taking over an asset is in the 70s in Lexington. The property manager missed the meeting because the pipe burst right above the office. And she's like out of breath, like, I'm clearing buckets of water out. I'm so sorry I missed the meeting. So always, you can have too much, but just making sure you have that sufficient piece on the front end, because like you said, that $300 per unit goes quick.
Real quick.
And do you have an estimate of how much extra on top of that you should factor in, or how do you kind of account for that?
Yeah, again, I think it ties into a couple things. It ties into your upfront CapEx budget. Like we talked about, if you've got a big budget, if you're raising a bunch of money up front to go and take care of the plumbing and take care of a lot of those things that are otherwise going to be happening on a recurring basis, that'll change how much you should go for. And also your R&M. If you want to skimp out on your OPEX, which obviously everybody does, and inflate their NOI and have a higher valuation, but if you budget your turnover, your repairs and maintenance in your operating expenses appropriately, that could have an effect also. But what I would say generally is probably doubling the lender reserve. So if the lender's at 300, probably another 300 makes sense. So if you're going to own the prop, if you don't want to finance that CapEx at a cash flow, you might just want to raise that up front and have that as a contingency. So if you've got a five-year business plan, you might just take 300 times five, and that's just your extra CapEx that maybe you don't have budgeted but expect to spend.
Okay, so rather than increasing the R&M by, you know, 300 per unit or so, just raise that on the front end.
Right. Because, I mean, if you put another $300 on your R&M, that's going to kill your, I mean, if you capitalize that, that's going to be like 5,000 per unit in value that you just lost. So,
yeah. Gotcha. Makes sense. And you mentioned this earlier, and me and Mike were actually talking about this morning. Do you have a formula or a tactic? And obviously it's very market dependent, you know, depending on the jobs, the population growth, but for a reversion cap rate being the cap rate that you'll sell the property at, do you have a way that you like to come to that number?
Yeah, I do. So I think the best way to come up with that number is just to be in the market and to see a lot of trades happen, underwrite a lot of deals and see what you're getting to in terms of what you deem to be market cap rate. And the reason why I stress market cap rate and not going in cap rate is because your going in cap rate could be very skewed based on certain idiosyncratic things with the deal, such as a loan assumption, or it's half vacant and it's a one cap, right? So there's so many different things that could affect your personal going in cap rate. It's not fair to use that as the basis for your exit cap rate. So really focusing on what does the market pay for the type of property you're trying to sell in 5 years. If you are trying to buy a B minus property, put 8,000 per unit into it and sell it as a B plus property in 5 years, then you need to kind of understand what is the cap rate, the prevailing cap rate today for B plus property, because that's what you're going to be selling. Similarly, if you're going to buy a deal and not touch it for 5 years, you know, maybe you could sell it as a value add and sell it for a 5 cap in 5 years. So I think it's just understanding of what the product is you're trying to sell, and then what is the market cap rate for that today, and then probably going 50 to 100 bips wide of that, depending on how aggressive conservative you want to be.
I say, no one has the crystal ball, but it's good to compare apples to apples of what you're looking for. And it's important to increase that exit cap rate, because that's your asset's going to get older. You want to make sure you're, like you said, you're conservative and what your risk tolerance for it. So I think that's a really key advice on what you're looking at. One thing, Rob, I think we can't wait to highlight is the book. What made you, why an underwriting book? What inspired you to do it? And what can readers look to get when they get their copy May 26th, or pre-order it now?
Right. So great question. When I was first learning this stuff and wanting to get involved, I was all excited, and there really wasn't this resource out there. Maybe you could read a few articles or talk to some people, but there just wasn't really that one resource that you could come and learn what I thought is such a critical component of the business and kind of the basis to build off of from there. And so because of that, and so many people have been asking me over the last few years, like, what did you do to learn? And, you know, what books did you buy, or what did you study? What course? And so I didn't have an answer. So I'm really happy to now have that answer and to have been able to put all my thoughts on paper and to be able to give somebody what I think is just such an awesome introduction to get started. And even more so than that, I mean, I don't think it's a totally beginner book, because that's not what I'm super passionate about. I dive into even more complex stuff and kind of take some points that maybe people in the business disagree with, agree with. And so I welcome that.
That's all. I don't know. I'm going to say, it is the answer. You are the answer, because then it's your credibility of building this product. And I know a couple of people on our team are in the process of writing books, and it's a hard thing. So I just want to commend you, and also super excited for the book, and, you know, super just excited to read it and just get the details, because I think in this space, everyone wants to be the capital raiser, so that necessarily they don't have to, I don't have to look at the numbers, because then there's an underwriter on the team. But there's, if you know the numbers behind it, you understand the cap rates, like you said, the NOI, there's so many different things. And I think we've all pounded our head against the same walls of hurdles of how we can improve our underwriting. And I mean, I went to school for 5 years of accounting and CPA, and just from gross potential rent to, you know, cash base, it's just so many different variables. So if you are serious about the space, would highly recommend getting Rob's book now, because if you can add that skill set in, it'll set you apart, not only now, but forever, of just understanding the numbers.
So what I would say also is, when I was writing the book, I had to figure out who my audience was. And I think it's my audience now is both passive investors and active investors. And I think the active investor, it's pretty straightforward, right? You're not going to get any traction if you're not out in the market, underwriting a bunch of deals, talking to brokers, and doing that side of the business. But for passive investors, I feel like I would guess that only 1 out of 100 passive investors are actually underwriting the deal that they're investing in. And they're putting a lot of money on the table, and, you know, they're making these big decisions, and they're often making them, I'll say, you know, underinformed or on an emotional basis. And so I think my biggest hope would be that past investors would get takeaways from the book and kind of motivate them to underwrite and realize, yes, this is accessible to me, because I think so many people want underwriting to seem like this dark art that is very complex and only for the experts, but it's not. I mean, in my book, I think if you read my book and you practice for 6 months, you've got it. And that's what I want past investors to have, is have that tool in their toolkit.
Yeah, that's one of the things I like about business and real estate in general, is like, yes, there's skill involved. Like, yes, you have to have certain skills and skill sets, but if you actually do the work and learn the product, and a huge part of that is underwriting, then you have a huge leg up on everyone else. Like I played sports in college, and you know, I would work my ass off in college, but no matter how hard I worked, sometimes there was a guy that was 6'4" and, you know, just a freak of an athlete. So it's like, it would made it a lot difficult. So in business and in real estate in general, if you understand the numbers, I mean, that's a huge asset to any team you're on, because surprisingly very little people actually do know the numbers. So, you know, that's, you know, good for you, Rob, for writing that.
And I just want to touch on too, is like, I was a former auditor. So you'll hear the story of what the business plan is and the PowerPoints and the webinars and all that good stuff, but the numbers also tell a story. So making sure you can fact check on what's going on line by line. I'm sure Rob's book goes granular on what to expect, but it's just making sure the story they're telling you matches the numbers they're giving you. And so simplicity is genius. So just making sure you check what's going for each. And I think it'll just be super helpful. Passive, like you said, passive and active, because passive investors have to know the numbers just as well as an active investor. So it's a very good point that you brought up, Rob.
All right, Rob, thanks for being on the show. Before we go to the expert pro tip, let's take a moment from our sponsors.
Is your money working as hard as you are? At RAM Partners, we partner with hardworking investors who are seeking true passive income through multifamily real estate. Partnering with RAM means transparent communication with our webinars, monthly statements, and newsletters. For more information, visit rampartners.com to register for our investor portal and to set up a call with our team. And we're back. So, Rob, we want to leave our investors with one pro tip besides buying your book on May 26th.
One pro tip is build a ton of relationships and do lots of due diligence. I think business is like dating, and it's like a lot of things in life. You want to get out there, experience a lot. And I don't know why I made this analogy, but
you're not wrong. Because once you partner, it's I do.
Exactly. And you know, we're in this business because we all think long-term, right? If you're a real estate investor, it's not a get rich quick game. These aren't, you know, quick trades. And so I think even more so, it becomes all about the relationships, all about the long-term nature of these things. And so taking the time up front to build those relationships and then to actually conduct the due diligence, I think that would have, you know, if I would have learned that sooner, I would have accelerated quicker, made fewer mistakes. And I think everyone could also benefit from that.
Awesome. Well, thanks again for being on the show. Like I said, I've known your partner for a while, and I've seen you and him connected. So, you know, very grateful and honored to finally have met you, even if it is virtually. What's the best way our listeners can get in touch with you?
Yeah, so like we talked about, the book, The Definitive Guide to Underwriting Multifamily Acquisitions, you could check that out on Amazon. I'm sure we'll have a link in the show notes. And also, if you if you're interested in the book, definitely head to our website, LoneStarCapGroup.com. And right at the top, there'll be a link to get a free copy sent to you of our underwriting model that I personally use every day, and allows you to follow along with my model and the book together to really maximize your learning experience. And if you have any questions or want to reach out to me directly, you can shoot me an email at rob@LoneStarCapGroup.com.
Awesome. Well, I appreciate it, Rob. And Rob does post a lot of publications as well. His newsletter has a lot of details, so make sure you subscribe to that as well. And there you have it, folks, another edition of the RAND Series Show. Make sure you like, comment, subscribe to the podcast wherever you get them. And if you have any questions for us or what you want to see next, hit us up at info@randseries.com. And until then, we'll see you next week.